Welcome back, listeners. Thank you for joining us tonight in the Creepypasta Book Club, the podcast where we read, analyze, and discuss significant creepypastas, no sleeps, and web horror flash fiction. We are your hosts, Jonah.
And Wednesday.
And today, we are on part 4 of Mother Horse Eyes, narratives 51 to 65. And before I go into the summary today, I just want to say I'm sick. Like, you can probably hear it in my voice. I'm kind of froggy. And it's hot as shit. I'm back in Australia, and it's so hot. I have multiple fans on. You can hear them in the background, probably. Not good audio today, and you're going to have to tolerate it. One of the final, brightest soldiers in the war against Q, the mother, the queen, General Castillo, has logged out. Without her, the war of the mind is lost, and the plague of flesh begins. The Black Hebrew Israelite returns, spreading the typical anti-Semitic talking points. However, he is also an addict. He is paranoid. He sees things which aren't there. It has ruined his marriage. He lost the house, lived on the streets, and that is where he saw the Nephilim, taking people for their needs. The author interrupts and pulls back. These ramblings are taken verbatim from his roommate at the Sober House, who he hates because he is such a raging anti-Semite conspiracy theorist. He also hates AA because the program funnels you towards belief in a god that the author does not think exists. Ben is actually relieved to hear Karen Castillo's words, believing her to be delirious and convinced she was still in the feed. However, she's still much too lucid otherwise. She even knows she's been disconnected. They pull Karen out and onto a gurney, dismissing her claims. One of the techs, Eliane, left early to call an elevator, and Karen knows his name too. She identifies him as her assassin. Ben looks at her arm casually and notices that she is bleeding from a small puncture, very much not protocol for a blood draw. He touches the spot, and there's definitely something there. Eliane reaches back to his hip, and Ben throws himself across the gurney, wrestling his gun away from him. Two shots fired. Eliane is dead. A man from an early hunter-gatherer society, whose band encounters a strange old woman along Mother River, who does not know the names of the fathers or the deeds. She calls the great people to hear her, but the son of Arayad does not trust her. She is the daughter of the river, with no human mother or father, as the ancient people were, and until recently she lived with a friendly people called the Painted Backs, until they were set upon and carried away by strangers, leaving her behind and naked on the shore. She asks the people to take her. As the daughter of the river, she has special powers which will make her useful to them, even though she is not of the people. She reaches into the river and pulls out three fat clams, each with a perfect round pearl inside, and the people, impressed, clamor to take her with them. But the son of Arayad still wonders whether the crone put those pearls in the clams herself. The corrosive nature of addiction. "There is nothing in your life," he claims, "that it cannot eat through, and nothing good enough to ever stop you from sinking deeper into it." The cat teaches us how to hunt. It is the mystery of subtlety, moving with the way of the world. The house she has chosen to enter is one with other cats living inside, but exposure to the oily ones has made them lose their subtlety. Ben wipes the blood off of his hands and cuts the pellet out of Karen's arm. Unsure what else to do, he calls the police. Karen is too weak to communicate, so he plugs her jacks back in to allow her to communicate by text, and she tells him that Q controls the police, who want to kill her because she is one of the Bread, a group of mental soldiers raised from birth to combat Q, the adversary. The police arrive and begin firing on Ben, so he allows Karen access to his through gate, and she takes control of the elevator to make their escape. They plunge down insanely fast to the parking garage, where Karen demands to be linked in physically to their escape vehicle. They peel out, encountering the police perimeter around the building, which Karen annihilates by calling in a drone strike. What kind of access does she have? An old woman wakes up happily to the smell of cat shit. She potters through her huge, decrepit old house, talking to the cats who live with her, and inventing stories about their lives as though they are characters in an interwar novel. Years ago, she used to be very sad, until Angelica entered her life. And since her passing, she has opened up her home to any cat who wishes to stay. Then, the cat appears, reminding her so very much of her Angelica. Ben, in the back seat of the Hawa luxury chariot, begins to contemplate throwing Karen out the window. He has just helped a powerful criminal hack Department of Defense systems and kill hundreds of cops, and he will get the death penalty for sure. Karen tells him they're going to upstate New York, where the key to defeating Q lies waiting. She tells him not to look back, and at first he thinks she is reading his mind, until he realized that behind them, Atlanta has been destroyed in a nuclear blast. The cat enters the old woman's house. She cannot understand what she is seeing, shapes which do not belong to the natural world, flat and straight, cats with dull minds and round bodies from overfeeding. She explores the house, baffled by every new mystery, while the old woman convinces herself that the cat is her Angelica, returned to her in another form. She stays in the house and begins to lose her mind, crying for food like the other house cats. At last she gains entry into the old woman's bedroom, the last unexplored territory, and finds nothing. There is no answer, and she runs away. Despondent that her Angelica has left again, the old woman snaps back to reality and decides to call her sister to get help. The grief for her little girl, Angelica, has made her forget that she was once a human. The crone joins the people, with her talent for finding food and her bubbling, musical voice. However, one day a young woman, Rima, disappears after going into the rocky lands with the crone. This is what happened to the painted backs, she says. Young women disappeared, then young men, then a strange pale warrior set upon the rest of the band. She says this evil is not brought by her, but by Mother River, who brings both good and bad, and furious, the people abandon her. However, another woman goes missing, and the people agree to find the crone again and learn from her how to increase good luck and decrease bad. The son of Arayed and another man are sent to look for her. In 1991, an entity appears in infraspace, breaking into every locked system, and then vanishing. More than a decade later, it returns, bigger. It can hack anything, take control of anything, taming satellites and forcing them to send out random data into the middle of the ocean. Once, it delivers its data package to a site near a warship, which views a giant stewed tomato of flesh rising out of the water, covered in veins and strange underwater appendages. It dives back beneath the water and is lost on sonar. But testing samples of the ocean shows the presence of human DNA, which can be traced back to the flesh interface built beneath the ocean near Artigas, Antarctica. All along, it turns out that they had built Q. So what do we think?
I didn't have, like, a talking point lead-in this week. I read it and took notes on what I read, and then didn't build, like, a new thesis or whatever.
Yeah, this one is kind of a less focused section, I think, than some of the earlier ones. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I took note of is, like, how little time is spent on flesh interfaces this reading. Like, there's almost no mention of them at all. Like, barely half a mention in 65 when he's talking about the appearance of the skinship.
There's a lot of, like, persona building in this one, and I was thinking about how, like, the last one we talked about being, like a gate, like speed bumps and stuff to get to, like, the rest of the story. And, like, in this reading, it feels like rapidly bouncing back between these things, and, like, the titles no longer, like, coupling, like, the titles go to, like, different parts. So you think you're going to get into, like, oh, this is a continuation of this story, but it's no longer that story, it's a different one. Like, a faster pace, like, unraveling. We've reached, like, an event horizon of some sort.
It stays much more in this high fiction kind of mode for most of it. Like, it bounces mm-hmm. between the author character's confessional type posts, which there are several yeah. of those in here. Like, there's a lot, and they all stay on mostly the same topic, and then bouncing to like the cat narrative or Alice's narrative, the old woman, or like the ancient people narrative, the Watcher narrative, as it's called, I think, in the
wiki yeah. or whatever. So this doesn't have anything to do with work. Well, it does, because it's the what we read. Okay, I have, here's my proposition for a Mother Horse Eyes adaption. So it's just the Karen storyline, right? Plays straight as like an animation, as an anime, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Like kind of Ghost in the Shell-y?
Yeah, it's like Ghost in the Shell, like full budget, like A-list crazy level animation, right? And then the rest of the story is told through, like little moments and, like, in the opening credits, like, oh, there's, like, 5 seconds of this one, 5 seconds of that one, and then, like, in the end credits, and then, like, in any merch that comes out, there's, like, another part of the story. So you'll get, like, a keychain, right? But, like, the store, like, one of the entries will be, like, printed on the back of the keychain.
Basically, you're proposing, like a singular feature film or short film with an ARG attached to it.
Yeah.
Not to say too much, like, having read it, you know, to the end before, I like that as a core idea, but I don't think that there's enough in the Ben and Karen storyline.
Oh, bummer.
Yeah. To support, like,
that's
an entire
disappointing
film. Yeah. Well, I mean, just because, like, there are so many different stories going on, and, like, that's one that I like a lot, but, like, not enough things happen in it, I think, to support a movie.
Oh, so it was starting to feel like a main line, is why I was like...
It is a main line, but it is also going to end soon.
I had written that down in my notes, and then immediately after I saw the title of which the section was posted, I was like, oh, well, I think that might be intentional, the vibe of that thing, because the title of the topic is unfortunate.
Was it the lolly one?
Yeah.
For those of you not following along with the Reddit posts, the original thread that narrative 59 was posted to, which is the one where Karen delivers the airstrike, it was posted in a subreddit, like a fairly obscure looking subreddit called Unmoderated Anarchism. And the title of the post is Lolly or Fuda, what do you guys think?
So I was like, oh wow, this is fuck on ones and stuff and like 3D graphic whatever nonsense they throw in for like big obeys, and like, oh well, I guess that was intentional.
Yeah, I have to wonder, like, hey Nick, what does that mean?
What do you mean?
Hey Nick, what was the point of that?
I feel like that's a good question for a lot of this reading.
there's nothing nearly as egregious as obviously the Nazi narrative. Like, we are over the hump, you know, you hit the speed bumps and kept going.
We do get a moment of it being almost as bad as that, but like not like, because we're not following the guy. It's more like thought philosophy about Nazism or whatever.
Yeah, like he goes really far with 52. Sean, the Black Hebrew Israelite character, says, like, oh, Hitler was doing the right thing because the Jews weren't really Jews. They're actually, you know, whatever. The horse shit they all say.
And in his confessional one, which is, like, the one where it's sort of like solipsism in writing is, like, an addiction, and he's, like, over the rack delivering this tale of violence or whatever, but in that he talks about, like, you wouldn't think that Nazis are undisciplined.
Oh, yeah, because, I pulled this quote specifically because I was like, hey, Nick, what does this mean? like, at least with 52, with Sean's rant, he follows it up by being like, hey, remember that horrible thing that I posted yesterday? That was my stupid roommate that I have to put up with. Isn't he awful? And then he goes on, I pulled this quote because it annoyed me so much. Like, I wanted to talk about this.
Yeah, please.
Thank you for bringing it up.
You're welcome.
Imagine the Nazi troops at Stalingrad, encircled by the Soviet troops, fighting against total annihilation. Would you look at these troops, these underslept, unshaven men, in stinking, unwashed clothes, and accuse them of lacking self-discipline? Would you say, tisk tisk, these Nazis are an undisciplined lot? Of course not. You would understand that the shabby state is not from a lack of self-discipline, but rather because they are concerned with other things, dire things. It reminds me of the way people do, like, Civil War, Lost Cause kind of stuff.
Yeah. I also think, to give him any kind of benefit of a doubt or whatever, he's tying the mythology of the only good addict to this kind of fascism.
Yes.
So that could be a thing. I think that's intended, but, you know.
It's hard to know how to read it, I guess.
Because there's some stuff that feels like, well, I don't know if someone with good intention would write something like this, but then there's some stuff that, like, if you didn't have, like, some kind of statement here, would you be tying these pieces together in this way?
Yeah. It's hard to know, like, whether the words as they are written should be read as, like, a condemnation of the principle of self-discipline and this myth of, like, the good addict? Or is it, because it doesn't seem totally like that to me. Like, and when he talks about, like, the Prince and Michael Jackson stuff as well, yeah. Right? It seems more like it's this lament for the fact that self-discipline would be good if it worked. That it is, like, a tragic shame that self-discipline doesn't work. More so than being like, this thing doesn't work. So, therefore, you should treat people more humanely, you know?
It's a little like the way people treat, like, the 50s or whatever. Like, this kind of, like, picket fence, idealized family doesn't work, and we should mourn it, instead of being like, this is like a gear in an abusive system. Yeah. It functions as intended.
Yeah, it was horrible for people. It caused so much suffering. But, God, wouldn't it just be so wonderful if our lives could be as idyllic as the 50s were supposed to have been? Like, if we could only get it back, we could do it right, you know?
It feels like that's what it's going for in some parts, but other parts is, like, a counter to it. It feels like a really, like, wrestling with its own, like, authorial identity or whatever, which is, like, what the story is.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where it's, like, something in the story has a funk to it, and you're like, well, you shouldn't do that. But it's so built into the story that you can't really critique it without, like, unraveling the story and sounding like you're not understanding, you know?
The author is obviously self-aware of the fact that he is doing these things because he knows that he's doing them. He is doing them on purpose.
Yeah.
And he repeatedly calls attention. he lampshades the fact that he is doing these, like, trash bag idiot things.
No one can critique you if you just acknowledge what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, if you're
mute.
Since you mentioned wrestling, it made me think of when the Nameless Jew talks about the principle of wrestling with God, and it reminded me of a thing that I spoke to you about, like, a little bit after we recorded the last episode. Like, I had kind of a revelation. I was like, oh my God, like, obviously, like, this is, like, I can't believe, like, I hadn't thought about this before, but, like, it was one of those, like, forest for the tree kind of things. That only occurred to me after thinking about the Nazi officer as, like, a sort of Paul stand-in, is that, like, obviously, the Nameless Jew is Jesus, like, pretty obviously. Like we have this imagery of, like the cutting of the stomach, the being offered the drink of water as he lays dying, the, like, passing of the burden onto the Paul proxy, the wrestling with God moment as, like, his Gethsemane, like...
It's like, listen, because you weren't thinking, like, we had entered that space not thinking about it as, like, Christian mythology, the mysteries of Christ in that moment. We were unpacking it being a Nazi protagonist and, like, misappropriation of, like, Jewish concepts.
It's very easy to get distracted by the fact that there's a Nazi protagonist, which, you know, like we were saying before, that's kind of the point, I think, of why he did it, because it is obfuscating. Yeah. You're meant to get distracted by the thing that is obviously distracting, so that it gets in the way of, like, the message. I also want to, like, problematize this real quick. It continues to piss me off as I think about it. Okay, because there is, like, this thing in Christian mythos when it has to interact with Judaism, because the acknowledgement has to be made that the historical figure of Jesus, whether or not you think he existed, would have been Jewish. He would have been a Jewish man living in the place that he lived in, which was where we lived, where we were living at the time, the Nameless Jew being, like, the one who earns the respect and the sort of loyalty of this violent Nazi character, and who convinces him to change his ways and change his mind, change his heart, and fight for, like, the force for good or whatever. It becomes the idea of, like, Christ is the only good and worthy Jew.
Yeah, that's why I think, like, besides obvious things, but, like, the section ringing, like, hollow and hollow redemption, because it's not the cyclical violence of that kind of narrative.
Yeah, it is part of the continuous violence that has been done onto Jews by Christians for the last 2,000 years. And it gave me kind of a thought, because Mother Horse Eyes deals with mother figures and motherhood and the concept of mm-hmm. a mother, mm-hmm. and thinking about, like, the concept of, like, the mother of Christianity, the like, grotesque and unwanted mother of Christianity literally being Judaism. And that's very much how Judaism tends to function in the perspective of Christianity, is this, like, mother that has to be superseded by its own son.
Yeah, and there's a weird, like, gendering of it in, like, people who are like that.
Yeah, like the way that Jews are often coded as, like, effete.
Feminine, yeah. It's weird. With that, like, that framing. Remember the Korean soldier guy?
Yes.
Like, it's sort of brought up here. I don't know if it's in the read-through or just in the notes of, like, the collected thing.
Mm-hmm. I don't remember it getting brought up, so it might just be in the,
It's just in the, okay. It gets, like, the sentence he says about, the devil took Jesus to the mountain to show him the kingdoms mm-hmm. and stuff.
Yeah.
And the desert and all that jazz. And, like, right, so the Korean man is, like, crucified by, like, mother interface.
Yeah.
Slicing or whatever, right?
Yeah. The segmentation.
Okay. That is attached to, like, the nuclear wasting of Atlanta?
Oh. That's interesting. Like in what way? Like, because I haven't read the collected narrative.
Let me find how it looks. There's also, like, an image attached to that one in the collected ones, and it's this, like, wired sculpture of, like, Lucifer and stuff.
Oh, yeah, it is, Morning Star by Paul Fryer. It's this, like, fucked up, like, hanging wire statue.
Yeah. There's a lot, I think, in the story where it's, like, Jesus has been crucified and he's calling out to God and there's not, like, a God to answer in the story. Like, there's a lot of people, like, reaching out to be like, hey, I'm suffering, God, deliver me in this way.
Yeah.
And there's no, like, call back. And then we get, like, that we have created this mass, so we have created God, and, like, the thing is attached to, like, the cat story in this way, that the mass is the cat looking for the mystery, and the mystery is our interaction with it, and, like, we domesticate this thing that then blows up the, like, city, and then is, like, the cause of our undoing, so we have domesticated this God, and that's what's happening? Question mark?
Because the thing with cats, I think cats come in from the other direction. Because cats are a reflection of naturalness, being in harmony with the world. Because, like, that's what's repeatedly emphasized in the cat's narrative. The thing that she constantly puts forward is that, like, the thing that all cats should strive for is to be subtle. Not make waves, basically, not defy the way that things are supposed to be. And, like, she views humans and cats that have been domesticated by humans as being against nature in the same way that we view Q. Because Q is also, and the mother, are also heavily linked to technology and to ascended consciousness. Mm-hmm. These are things that defy nature. And one of the things that I took note of in the Watcher narrative, they have domesticated cats. Like, they're a hunter-gatherer people. They're a nomadic people. Historically, cats become domesticated by sedentary groups because they, you know, grow crops, they grow especially grain. Mice are attracted to the grain that has been stored up. Cats come and eat the mice, and they form this mutual relationship with the people who run the farms and mill the grain and stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Where, like, cats are kind of, in the story, taking on the role that you would see prehistoric man having with dogs, right? Usually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, they're sort of, like, guide cats. They're hunting cats, basically, who come mm-hmm. with the group and follow along with them and are their companions. And this group, the people, have this way of life that is framed to be like this is a natural way of life that they are intending to follow, what they refer to as flow, like a power, a current, and that these things are like and an inherent part of the world, which is why cats are able to live with them, and why we don't see dogs with them, because, like, the dog, like, we have in the dog dream.
Yeah, like, we've altered the dog.
Yeah.
We've changed, because I haven't read beyond this, so I don't know.
Yeah.
But, like, the way this is framing it sounds like the mother is coming because we have, like, done technology and, like, corrupted the natural flow of her, like, being, so now we're, like, rightfully being, like, wiped out by, like, natural hunger or whatever.
I choose to read it from, like, the opposite direction. Like not that it's a natural hunger, but that it is, like, the consequence of unnatural behavior is the thing that that allows the mother to have an influence over us.
If, like, the mother is the wolf, that's, like, the natural part of the world is why I was, like, coming from it, from that. Also, I think it's not, I don't think it's funny, haha, but, like, funny that the guy invents sexism for humanity.
The Watcher narratives make me think of Dogscape, I think, more than anything else. Like,
yeah, big Dogscape vibes.
I hadn't read Dogscape at the time, but, like, having read that and, like, talked about it with you a lot, mm-hmm. and, like, going back and reading this, it makes me think of, not in the way that Dogscape was written, but in the framework that people have of,
yeah, early man and stuff.
Yeah, like, the idea of, like, the prehistoric or naturalized human is in this state of, like, built-in sexism kind of thing. Like, it is much less overt and much less, like, nasty than a Dogscape. But, like,
and, like, it also just makes this guy sound specifically sexist because the other people in the tribe aren't vibing on his same wavelength.
Yeah, yeah, the fact that he's like, well, you know, this old woman isn't capable of having children anymore, you know, we shouldn't waste our resources on taking care of her.
When, like, and everyone's like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, and we know from, like, archaeology, basically, that, like, prehistoric people were, like, you know, very pro-social in a lot of cases. Like, they would look after people, and they would take in people from other groups from all types of ages and persuasions and stuff. And it wasn't about, you know, you have to give them children to become a valuable part of the tribe. Like,
and he, like, frames it like the valuable women, but, like, the girl in the story who gets taken is, like, pre-puberty, right? Like, so she wouldn't be doing that. I think she was a child, but she might have, I don't know.
I don't think they mentioned the age.
No, I just assume so based on other stuff that happens, like the other girl snatched and stuff in the story.
Well, like, based on the lolly or food, which one do you guys prefer?
Yeah, that too. Okay, it's interesting that people do this, like, fantasy caveman, manhood stuff, while also wanting stories like this, because, like, the folklore and, like, the mysticism would be, like, spearhead by people who are, like, people, like, the people we discard in present day.
Yeah. We have a lot of evidence that, like, people with disabilities or, like, complex mental illnesses and stuff, or people who are very old, were the people who were more likely to be considered, like, you know, to have some kind of spiritual relationship, at least in many groups in the ancient world. I shouldn't make sweeping generalizations.
Yeah, this isn't universal. We can probably find and post, like, specific examples.
Yeah.
It's just, like, we're talking freestyle.
Yeah.
And it's not like we have an encyclopedia knowledge of every notes we could ever pull up.
Yeah, like, we are not...
Yeah.
We are not ourselves anthropologists. We're just people with an interest in anthropology. And, like...
Yeah, and a podcast.
I think the author is also interested in anthropology, but is just bringing with him biases.
Baggage.
Which everyone does in any subject. Like, we're not saying, like, oh, look at this guy with his fucking baggage, like as though we're any better.
No.
But, like...
Yeah. If, like, we did a postmortem on episodes, I'm sure we'd find, like, a dozen of things we were like, oh,
yeah,
well.
Like, things we were being kind of dumb about.
Yeah.
In general, the Watcher narrative is interesting in the way that it shows those, like, biases and perspectives on what we consider ancientness and, like, the idea of tradition and stuff. Like, because we know that early society was, it began as hunter-gatherer groups, right?
Mm-hmm. And, like, the significance of rivers to people because we're, like...
That's where stuff grew.
Like, animals go there. Yeah, stuff grows there. Animals grow there. And there's, like, evidence to show that we were, like, scavengery prior to hunting E. And, like, rich amino acids from fish helped in our evolution.
Helped us get these big brains. The way that it is written... Like, we don't have a frame of reference for the time that it is. We can guess that it's prehistoric because of stuff that happens later on makes me believe that it is intended to be set in like prehistory, like they are like early Homo sapien kind of people.
Yeah, I think based on like whatever cultural like association about that kind of like how people in fiction write like prehistoric man stories.
Yeah. Like the tone that it's written in, like, is something that you see in, like, rough translations that are given to, like, stories that are... When I say fairly recent, I mean, like, within the last, like, 500 years or so of different mythology that you see in, like, Sub-Saharan Africa... Or from different Native American groups. Like, the way that people tend to, when they're translating it into English, that they tend to write in this sort of, like, more simplified language with certain ideas and vocabulary repeated often. This sort of, like, stumbling way that you have to write around a thing as though there's not, like a word that you can put to it. Like that's what I mean by rough translation. And the way that, like, that... Because there are hunter-gatherer groups who live now.
Exist now, yeah.
The way that people write and talk when they want to get across that people are ancient and their way of life is ancient, is something that stood out to me.
Yeah, like, I didn't think, like, consciously about it, but, like, I just assumed it was prehistoric based on, like, all that.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's coding it in that way.
Coding, that's good, yeah.
Where, like, when you read, like, you can read translations of Homeric texts that are written in a way that does not do all of this stumbling and rough translation in a translation that is very naturalistic. And these are stories and from cultures that are sometimes older than these more recent translations that you get from groups who are much more racialized than the Greeks are the white European, like, Anglosphere perspective is what I'm getting at.
Yeah. Vocabulary you'd pick for, like, stuff like that. Like, you'd, like, people would aim to, like, naturalize it more because, like, even the word for that is, like, janky, like, to naturalize something. A thought I had when we were talking, like, so to reframe the wildcat again to, like, us and, like, the mystery and all that stuff, we get the answer the cat is looking for in, like, there's not a yes-no sort of thing, but, like, we learn about Angelica in the story, like, why she's like this, and, like, the cat doesn't understand because it can't comprehend, like, if we are the cat, and the interface is, like, the mystery of Angelica and stuff, or, like, people in general. Like, even if we are given the answer, like, she shows Angelica, like, the person, like, her dead daughter.
Yeah.
And the cat can't comprehend this. So, like, even if we get, like, the answer told to us forcefully, directly, we could not comprehend because we don't have, like, the capability to.
Yeah. The reason why the cat enters this space in the first place is that she is suffering from the same thing that Alice, the old woman, is suffering from. And she is reaching out for answers that Alice, without intending to, tries to give her. And that answer is that even though they're so different, that they have no crossover experience, Alice is kind to cats because she values kindness. Like, she's lonely and wants companionship. and all humans are alternately, like, kind or cruel because they're individuals with their own motivations. Like, some are good, some are bad, and with their own personal sufferings, just like the cat. Even though, like, she identifies herself as belonging to a monolith of cat, she also has her individual grief for her kitten that drives her to do something unreasonable. But, like, there is no ability to, like, mutually communicate between these two entities. Like the gap is just too big.
Oh my god, yeah. Yeah, that's the coolest part of the story.
Communication gaps are another big, like, thing in Mother Horse Eyes. Like the idea mm-hmm. of, like, the gap in communication between any two living things versus the inherent seamless oneness communication of the mother.
The interface, yeah. I think we also get, like, a cool peek of that into, like, the internet, like, pod story.
Yeah, with Karen being, like, able to just, like, interface seamlessly, naturally, because yeah. she's been bred to do this. And, like, that mother connection is replicated in the immediacy of the hygiene beds. Like, everything is this instant stimulation while also being totally shallow.
Seeing that also as, like, the gap between, like, a casual user and someone who's, like, a part of it, and, like, how even if, like, you are, like, addicted to these things, you're never going to have that kind of, like, oneness with it.
Yeah. Even though she is able to seamlessly communicate with machines in a way that surpasses what any other person could do, she
is still, like, flesh.
Yeah, she cannot communicate with Ben seamlessly. The only way that she can mm-hmm. communicate with him, because her voice box is so wasted that she can't use it. The only way that she can communicate is through text into his like view screen, and it's inadequate.
We see her, like, struggling with, like, spelling and stuff because so much of her interaction is, like, instantaneous techno emotions.
Yeah.
Also, that part where they explain that she's, like, a child soldier and, like, after everything we got is, like, the big daddy of, like, anti-Semitic conspiracies. Like,
yeah, I mean, well, like, with anti-Semitism, it's not child soldier, so
it's, like, the whole, like, this secret Kabbalah of, like, New Jerusalem and stuff like that was in that chunk there.
Yeah. It's a fun coincidence that the mother's code name, or the creature that is implied but not necessarily stated to be the mother, is Q. Given what we've talked uh-huh. about with, like, you know, Mother Horsehide's relationship to conspiracy theories and, like,
yeah,
and QAnon and stuff, and it's funny because, like,
that has this to be is a coincidence, but, like,
yeah, it is a total coincidence because this came out a year and a half before the first QAnon post, which was in October of 2017. These posts that we've been reading are in May 2016. Like, the gap is so huge, but, like,
no proof that we're not in the Mother Horse Eyes universe.
Like, okay, English only has 26 letters.
We'll put that on the table. It seems fucking weird. People want to use it for weird stuff.
Like the reason why they use Q, I think it's because the agent or group of agents represented by the letter Q, they're called that because they have Q level access or something like that. Like, it's some fucking mumbo jumbo like that. Yeah.
Like, you know so much about it because you listen to the podcast and you stay, like, really hooked into, like, that kind of stuff. But, like, every time you deliver stuff, I'm like, wow.
Yeah.
People need to just, like, okay, we need deprogramming, but, like, to incorporate, like, LARP in the deprogramming. Because, like, you can't, like, cut that cold turkey.
I don't know if they talk about it as much anymore, like, with post-COVID mainstreaming of QAnon. But, yeah. Like, one of the historical things, like, when it was first really popping off for people was, like, the battle with the accusations of being a LARP. And, the like, one of the big refrains among, like, early QAnon adopters was, like, all this for a LARP? Like, that was something that Q would actually say.
Oh, I can see it. I've
because, like, yeah, that is what you're doing. Like, you need to go to, like, an escape room or something.
Just get it out of your system. The fascist elements or whatever are funneling our future authors, our future game designers.
I mean, the thing is that, like, most people who are, like, really desperately into QAnon, like, don't read books.
Yeah, this is what happens, like, this is what your brain does when you're in, like, a...
if you're the kind of Christian that doesn't read books, you're probably gonna get into QAnon, unfortunately, because you need that stimulation. Like, and that's why we need to promote literacy.
I think that's what Mother Horse is about. It's all been a long PSA for this. Also, I kind of, because I read this in, like, a span of, like, 3 days, I kind of forgot 51 was explaining what was happening with Q. So I was like, who the fuck is this?
Yeah, that's, I think that's the first time we get the Q name drop.
Yeah, I was like, oh, that's a cool thrash metal poem. Anyway. And didn't think about it again. There's, like, really lyrical ones, like, I really like poetry, so you'd think I'd, like, latch on harder to these sections. But, like, really, like, lyrical poetry ones, unless it feels like a really sharp note, I'm like, okay, well, that was weird. Anyway, next entry.
It's especially hard because this is your first time reading, and so those moments that, like, are foreshadowing, because they're done in a little bit of an assed way sometimes, it's easy to be like, oh yeah, whatever, okay, moving on to something that's not wasting my time.
Yeah, like, I know they're all, like, connected, so they build up on each other, so it's more like, oh, okay, that one was just weird for the sake of being like that, and not like, oh, that is a vital information in Queen to survive.
One of the interesting things about Ben that I was thinking about is, like, you mentioned the child soldier thing with Karen, and mm-hmm. Ben, I mean, we know that he's a soldier, but the interesting thing about him, I think, is that he never stops being a soldier, right?
Yeah.
Like, in a lot of stories where we have, you know, like, an ex-military guy, it's often presented as, like, you know, a guy who has escaped that life and, you know, wants nothing to do with it anymore and has to make that sacrifice and sort of backslide into it in order to, like, save people and do the right thing and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Like, versus Ben, who is explicitly like, I'm so relieved to be back. Like, I'm so glad that I get to, like, do action and fight and kill and no thinking, just hair trigger. And, like, comparing it to, like, the like, violent feed games that he and his friends were playing to then being, like, deployed as, like, a 19-year-old onto a battlefield.
Yeah.
It reminds me pretty authentically of the way that, like, you hear military and ex-military people talk about service sometimes.
Yeah, that's, like, reality for a lot of things.
Like, especially guys who haven't been, like, radicalized after leaving the service or anything.
Yeah. I think, like, the mythology of, like, the guy who comes back over realizes that was bad, that was a bad time, and then, like, joins the leftist cause is, like, not a bigger representation of people who are like, man, I really miss doing murder and war and stuff.
Well, I don't think, like, the mythology of, like, coming back over and becoming, like, a like a hardcore anti-war person or like a hardcore leftist is as much of a media thing as just, like, because that would be way too political for a lot of the media that we get about war and post-war.
It's like a entertainment fantasy more than anything.
Yeah, it's because it is structured that way literally just to give the character an arc, because the story is ultimately about how it is good to, like, be in the military and serve your country and shit. So yeah. It has to be this, like, starting at this low point where it's, like, the disillusionment and the cynicism with the system and the way the military is being run and blah, 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 and then gets back into it and, like, never, like, rejoins, like, the service that they were a part of. It's almost always, like, as a rogue element, like a Dirty Harry kind of thing, or, like, going into...
Yeah, that too. You get, like, a special designation because you went through, like, this arc and realized, actually, the military is good, so you're rewarded with, like, a special boy badge.
you came out of it because, like, oh, it was hell over there, but then, like, you get back into it because it's the right thing to do, versus, like, Ben, who is, like, we already know that he's kind of an asshole. Like, he's kind of, like, a condescending shithead, and he's like, damn, it feels good to kill.
Yeah, he's the same sort of, like, elitism, like, the guy who doing his confessionaries does, like, I'm the only good addict, I'm the only good guy doing public service ever, and I deserve to, like, climb up the ladders of a different field after my time on the battlefield. And, like, then he gets back to killing. He's like, oh, yeah, this is it.
The other thing that made me think of, like, the mention of the violent feed games made me think of, like, how much ground has been ceded by people. Obviously, video games don't make people violent, but people are so determined to prove that, like, their video games and their media, like, the media that they like, has never done anything wrong. It's like, and could never be bad in any way. It could never do any kind of harm. Therefore, you have to deny the very existence of propaganda.
Yeah, it's so bizarre. Or, like, conditioning. Like, those, both these things are real. And, like, it's environmental, it's social, it's, like, if you're born in, like, a society and you spend your entire life in a violent space, you yourself will be violent, but it's not, like, a condemnation. It's, like, it's weird to expect people to have, like, tools and stuff to, like, you know?
Yeah.
But, like, a lot of what people dismiss as, like, that is, like, that person was violent because they were entitled to the violence. They weren't violent because, like, society failed them. They were violent as intended.
Yeah, society primed them for that violence in a lot of cases.
Encouraged this level of violence. Like, even in, like, a utopic society, like, we construct with, like, computers or whatever, there's still going to be, like, a percentage of level of, like, of violence done, but, like, a social community that does, like, if it's just, like, not an avenue for violence, there's less violence.
Yeah, like, based on what we know about, like, ecology and how to feed people, there's at least going to be a level of violence when you have to deal with animal matter. Like, it's not less violent just because it's being done to an animal instead of a person. And I say that as someone who is pro-eating animals. I'll eat the shit out of an animal. Even in the most ethical possible manner of animal husbandry, with the purpose of eating them at the end, it's still violent. Even if you could make, like, a purely vegetarian society function on a large scale, there's still a level of violence involved in safeguarding crops. Like, you can't live in a truly violence-free world. The best you can do is make that violence as ethical and thoughtfully done as you can.
Yeah. It gets into, like, butchering ethic and stuff.
Yeah.
Like, and, like, the introduction to such a thing. I'm really, a lot of times stories, this has nothing to do with Mother Horse Eyes, a lot of times stories like that stick out where people, like, live on farms and stuff, or introduced to, like, farm-to-table stuff, like, really, really young, and they're, like, they have to, like, go kill the animal themselves, and how that's, like, was, like, a significant, like, negative impact on them. Like, there's this one I was thinking of, like, his family has a small, like, chicken farm for, like, eggs and chicken stuff, and he's at the age where he can, like, help in a more, like, hands-on sort of way, so it's like, a really big deal, and he gets, like, to raise a chicken for them to eat later, and it's like, oh, I have now killed this person who I was supposed to protect. This was my friend, this was a pet, and now I've killed and ate it, sort of, like, the feeling the person got afterwards, even though the intent was to, like, introduce this child to, like, ecosystem and farming and eating. That can get into, like, the nature of addiction and stuff. Like, if are certain people more predisposed to, like, having addictive personalities or whatever? Or is it all, like, social condition kind of thing? Is it genetics? Like, does it matter at, like, where it, like, ends or anything? If you are more predisposed to violence, then it would be in society and your own personal interest to, like, avoid things to cause, like, your brain to associate violence with, like, reward.
I know, like my mom and a lot of my family believe that, like, that, like, addiction runs in the family, that, like, there's a predisposition towards it. So she's always been, like, really, really concerned about, like, my brother and I with, like, drinking or anything like that. Like, she's always been really worried about us, like, getting in over our heads. I mean, and yet she's like, you know, she's fine with pot, with any kind of thing, even though, like, we know that pot can also be habit forming too. Like, people say, like, oh, like, pot's not addictive. It's like, things don't have to be addictive in your brain to be habit forming if you rely on it as a coping mechanism, which a lot of people do. Like,
like, people separate things into, like, addiction and then, like, stuff that's, like, not that, but, like, any habit forming thing that you can't stop that, like, affects, like, your cognitive ability and, like,
anything that you can rely on. That's why gambling is addictive. There's nothing particular about gambling that changes your cognition the way that a drug does, but it is still, like...
Yeah, it's just fun.
Extremely debilitating if you... I just registered what you said.
Sometimes fun things are bad. Like, it's okay to, I think it's okay to break down, like, these complex things into, like, easy bite terms, because, like, I don't know, sometimes fun things are bad. Sometimes you can be like, well, I can't do that right now. Sometimes it's just that, you know?
The way that he, the author character, talks about addiction is, like, really compelling, I think, in the fact that it is so deeply invested in this character's perspective, you know?
Yeah, it feels really, it feels, like, weighted by the character's, like, point of view.
The first time that I heard it, I found it really annoying, because it was very, like, it feels kind of preachy and kind of melodramatic.
Yeah.
It, like, especially the part where he's, like...
Yeah, it's both.
The part where... If you think that I'm being dramatic, it's because you don't know anything, which is like a rhetorical thing that I fucking hate. It annoys me so much when anybody does that.
But it also leans to, like, the whole thing, like, I have secret knowledge.
Yeah.
Conspiracy kind of stuff.
But it's, and it's also specifically because, like, because this is a person who's very troubled, first of all, and secondly, because this is not actually, like a statement of fact. This is an argument. Yeah, this is rhetoric, and it's coming from this person who is very damaged and very cynical and very upset. Like, you brought it up earlier, like the wrestling with no God kind of concept.
Yeah, like the cry out and there's no one there. There's not
the why have you forsaken me?
Yeah, the fixation with this, like, certain like point in, like, the Jizai mythology is, like, in it. Like, the whole thing with, like, the Nazi tabloo, the whole, like, the touching the wounds, the water, Roman guard thing.
Yeah.
And, like, in it is also, like, his mother comes, Mary and stuff, with, like, washes his face, and then, like, the god part, and, like, getting hurt at the end, and the whole, what's it? And, like, that's, like, absent here, and the absence here is, like, the mystery of the interface, or whatever. The whole thing with, like, self-discipline, like acknowledging that something is bad even though you enjoy it is different than believing in a concept of, like, self-discipline, because people need, like, community and social structure and, like, help.
He does get to the heart of, like, the problem with the concept of self-discipline is that, like, we are living soft things that need softness sometimes, and to be disciplined inherently is to be hard on yourself.
Yeah.
And the harder you are on yourself, the more deprived you're going to be, and the more deprived you are, the more that you need relief.
It's kind of like a wire mother cloth mother thing happening in the story, but the wire mother is the one that has the food. Right? I can't remember if that's actually how it is in the thing, if the wire mother has food and the cloth mother has nothing.
Yeah, the wire mother has food, the cloth mother has nothing. The monkeys gravitate towards the cloth mother because they need that social stimulation and that softness as much as they need food.
That's what feels like a bit in the story, that the mother, the meat mother, the physical mother that, like, people interact with, this is the wire mother in that the cat lady is, like, in the delusion, right, of this, like, community and feeding the cats, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we get the idea of this, like, point of, like, obsession, this point of, like, unnaturalness is the one providing food, is the one providing, like, stimuli, I guess.
Yeah.
And, like, what's needed is, like, the cloth mother to heal, but there's an absence of a cloth mother in the story.
Yeah. Even the food that she gives, even though the cat talks about the food being good, it's also, we see, bad for the cats, or framed as being bad for the cats. There's, you know, there's a lot of fat phobia going on in this story that we could break down.
Yeah, we should talk about that.
Because this is a story about body horror and grotesquerie, right?
And people have trouble not doing, like fat equals scary or whatever when it's like, it's really lazy and like tasteless and stupid.
Using fat bodies as like a stand-in for the kind of like grotesque body horror that we see in the interfaces or like and that's a common thing in horror where like, fat bodies are viewed with like this very serious disgust. And like Alice is also framed by the cat as being like bloated, fat, just like the cats are. And Alice is like made out to be extremely grotesque as well, just in general. Yeah. Like she lives in this house that is like wall to wall piss and shit. And she like copes with it by framing it in her mind as biscuits, love biscuits.
Yeah.
And like she pours cat food on her bed to try to bring the Angelica cat closer.
And it's like her grief has driven her to do this. Like she might have had like pre-existing stuff, but like in the story it's like framed as her being like so grief-stricken, like it's crushed her mentality.
Yeah. But like even though we can sympathize with that grief, it is still supposed to make her repulsive to
like,
us.
Like gross, yeah. Also, I didn't read beyond this. I just like saw in passing at some point it living in the world. This is the second mentioning of Angelica in the story.
Yeah.
This is where it comes in. So she's a porn star in that one. And this one, she's like a cat lady. And it's interesting that we don't get really any other place where the like another character reappears in somewhere else.
Or at least a name.
Yeah, like name. Like we get the mother in like reiterations, I guess. So that's a thing. Like, different, like, ways we see the interface. So that could be it.
Also, Angelica is the daughter, and Alice is the old woman.
Oh, the daughter. Sorry. The daughter is Angelica, but, like, in an alternate timeline where she lives, I guess, she becomes a porn star. I don't know what we're supposed to take away from that. The fact that there's, like, a repeating character with that kind of story arc.
Well, we don't know if... It is the same name, but, like... I think that might just be, like you brought up Angel being, like similar to the word angel last time, and, like, Nephilim, I think these are just, like, repeated uses of things referent to angels.
Okay, that feels, okay. I think there are more names he could have picked, other names in the English language that exist that sound like angel, but okay.
I mean, they're all variants on, like... Angelica, yeah, Angelique, just, yeah. Whatever.
Like, even Alice is, like...
Well, the thing that we would pick as, like, a reference point for Alice...
was Alice in Wonderland. Yeah. Right. Yeah, I got it. But just other A sounds.
And the like, madness and distorted perception that she's experiencing, I think it's, like, an intentional...
nod to it, because it's also sort of, like, people are like, that's the drug story.
But, yeah, like, in general, like, old women... and mothers in this story are presented in pretty, like, they are physically vile to the narrators of other stories. Like, when they look at...
He spends more time agonizing if he had, like, sexual intercourse with an old woman and, like, than, like, I don't know, other stuff he could be worrying about. And, like, then the caveman guy is, like, revolted by this old woman existing when, like... that would probably be really dope to have someone that old in your tribe or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, like, that's useful for looking after other children. Like...
yeah. Which, like, she kind of... that's why I guess I thought Rima was a child. Because that's the function... function's a bad word. But, like, she's, like, an old lady and there's, like, free babysitting.
yeah, the social function of having older women in a group, historically.
She's passing on wisdom... old lady vibes and watching the kids.
The kindness of these old women is often just like inherently destructive.
Yeah.
Like the narrator's mother, the author character's mother, her kindness is destructive because it allows him to have like a landing place to continue to spiral out after losing his job.
Oh.
This enabling factor. And, like, her grief is represented by this sad, crumpling, deflating face. It is also another moment of, like, grotesque. Yeah. Alice is presented as just this, like, filthy, insane woman living in cat shit and squalor. She's overfeeding these cats and, like, ruining their lives and ruining her own life because, she, like, her kindness is itself destructive. It's kind of implied, or at least the people on the river think that the crone, like, her, that her kindness that she has expressed to them
has, like, cursed them.
Yeah, that she has brought some kind of curse upon them by drawing the attention of the people who attacked the painted backs. Even though she has been good to them and has tried to teach them things and give them things and, you know, helped them gather food and told them stories and stuff. And that's another thing that made me think of Dogscape, was, like, one of the few, like, good points of Dogscape was one of the things that we discussed, was, like, the idea of, like, cosmic horror being something that loves you.
Like,
and can only express that love in a way that is dangerous to you and destroys you.
Because your body can't, like, take the love. Like I really enjoy stuff like that, that's, like, love we couldn't comprehend. We don't have, like, the capacity to. We don't have, like, we can't withstand it.
Yeah, and even though, like, in many of these stories, mothers are presented as, like, domineering and dangerous. Like particularly where the mother Horse Eyes, is concerned, motherhood is also tied very much to this kind of cosmic horror love. It is not intending to hurt you, but it can't help but hurt you. Like, you cannot...
Like, it's its nature, too.
Yeah. It is inevitable that you are going to suffer at the hands of the thing that loves you.
It's like the mother creature, the mother, like, concept is, like, it has to hurt you. It's, like, what comprises it of this role. If this was, like, if the pain of the thing it does was absent, it wouldn't be mother.
Yeah, like, the reason why it's not just a flesh beast from the stars is a thing that in some way wants to take care of you. It wants to be together with you. It wants to assimilate you into it. And by doing that, kind of can't help but destroy the thing that makes you who you are.
Oh, that's good. Oh, that's okay. So let's tie it to, like, the addiction stuff. Like, obviously the whole thing is, sorry. But, like, in order for him to, like, heal and stuff, he has to destroy, like, okay, there's, like, in therapy and stuff, the idea of, like, you're dealing with, like, a personality disorder, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have to, like, give up a certain amount of, like, your held identity to, like, change your behaviors.
Yeah.
And that's, like, scary because it's, like, you, and it's hard to conceptualize what you're going to look like afterwards.
Yeah.
And that's probably also, that's obviously, like, a thing in addiction therapy, too. And so something is, like, that is going on, like, in order for him to, like, but it's, like, framed as meet fear,
yeah,
right?
Like this combination, meet fear and, like, arrested development, I don't want to grow up kind of attitude.
Yeah, all while putting on airs of being, like, I'm better than other people. I'm, like, I'm more evolved than other people because I've, like, maintain this, like, eternal child cause and effect responsibility level of, like, dealing with stuff.
Yeah, it's the Holden Caulfield posture of being simultaneously better and worse than other people.
It's all coming together.
The character, like, the author character, also, like, it's this, like, atheistic despair, right?
Yeah.
Because, like, the core emotion, like what you talked about, the why have you forsaken me in a godless universe kind of thing, is that, like, the divine tragedy of Mother Horse Eyes is that, like, there is no god to set things right for him. Like, there's no parent that can look out for him well enough to keep him from fucking up his own life. So, like, the mother being, like, a representative of this senseless violence, unintentional violence, in a universe where there are no fathers to, I guess, correct the excesses of the mother, which is, like, the way, like, modern Christianity, like Victorian period, especially onwards, mm-hmm. the framing of, like, what the sort of gender relations are supposed to be like in the married household, right? Mm-hmm. Is that, like, the mother is supposed to be the doting and caring figure, is supposed to provide the spiritual and emotional well-being, and then is balanced by the father, which is, you know, representing the rationality and the strictness and dominance that is going to set someone right. And if you have too much of an excess of that maternal feeling in your life, it's going to spoil you.
That definitely feels like what's happening, especially in, like, overall, but, like, this reading specifically, because we have so much of, like, it back-to-back of different slices of that.
Yeah. I also, like, as I was reading this, because I saw Amadeus on stage recently, and yeah, it made me think of that also. It was so good. Oh my god. You guys should be jealous. It was so good.
I'm so jealous of you.
It was Michael Sheen on stage. People who know me know what that means to me. he was so amazing in it.
Oh, I'm surprised you, like, survived.
But the core tragedy of, at least in this version of Amadeus that they put on at the Opera House.
Oh, yeah.
It is framing, like, the core tragedy of the story, at least in my opinion, as being, like, kind of the American Psycho tragedy, right? Where it's, like, a person who wants to stop being the way that they are, being in this destructive mode that they are in. Like, not just self-destructive, but, like, outwardly destructive.
Yeah. And they have no tools, too.
Yeah. Like, is sort of, like, begging the whole time. Like, is someone going to stop me? Is God going to come down and interfere? Like, when is God going to smite me and strike me down and make me stop doing this bad thing that I don't want to do anymore? Because Salieri is only hurting himself because he has no power over whether Mozart is successful, or whether Mozart is unsuccessful, I should say, because what he does have the power to do is to help Mozart. He could reach out and, like, be Christian and neighborly and help him achieve his dreams and surpass Salieri, except for the fact that his stubborn pride doesn't let him. Mozart is this, like, nasty little shit. He's an immature kid. He can't be trusted to make his own decisions. And, like, he could have had a figure in his life, in the narrative of the story. I don't know anything about the real life Mozart, but, like, in Amadeus, like, he could have had someone looking out for him and guiding him and tempering him, pushing people to see his genius, because Salieri is framed as being basically the only person who understands at the time what a genius Mozart was until, you know, 30 years after his death, but he refuses. And so he denies himself more of this music that he loves, that he obsesses over, that makes him see God for really the first time in his adult life, because he cannot stand knowing that someone who is not him, and someone who he sees as vulgar and undeserving, has reached God before him and is favored by God. Like, because he cannot handle that, the only thing he can do is destroy him. I should say, like, he does not destroy Mozart. Mozart destroys himself. Salieri helps it along. He encourages Mozart to continue making bad decisions. But then, like, even when things seem to be about to miraculously go right for Mozart, he still fails without any intervention from Salieri. He was always going to
like, what agony.
Fail in this way, and Salieri had no part in it. And he convinces himself that, like, he is part of this, this divine tragedy of, like, simultaneously seeing this person that he hates, he calls him the creature, reach artistic heights that he never could, and then his punishment later on to not even be recognized for the way that he destroyed Mozart. Because he never did. Salieri is punishing himself because he has no effect on Mozart's life. He's only hurting himself. And I see that very, very much in Nick, like, the author character.
I think there's, like, a kind of, like humility would, like, for lack of, like, a non, like, humility feel, people use it, like, non, like Christian, but it feels like a loaded thing to say in the context of the story.
Yeah.
But like all of what you were saying, like Nick the character and stuff like that, their inability to have humility prevents them from enjoying like the pleasures that they would have get otherwise. Like, he can't enjoy the music, like, and he can't, like, if he invested in his art, he would probably be, like, brought up along with him. He would have, like, just, like, a better, happier life. And how people do that to themselves, like, in the real world, like, and how much, like, people who are stuck in, like, abusive cycles will continue to, like, dig down into it because, like, the opposite would have to be, like, admitting some sort of emotional incorrectness.
Yeah, like you would have to ask for help or, you know, admit that there is a problem in some way. And also admit that another person could help you. Because I think that's a very confronting thing in itself for a lot of people, that, like, you're not an island, you're not totally independent. Another person could change your life for the better if you allowed them to have that power over you.
Mm-hmm. Plenty of people who have certain problems like this will be, like, negative about themselves, but it's not the same thing as, yeah. Like...
Yeah, like, self-deprecation is different than self-reflection, which, like,
yeah,
a lot of, like, current, especially, like, online mental health discourse has mistaken self-deprecation for self-reflection, where, like, extreme self-deprecation, like the sort of like Bo Burnham mode of interacting with the world, that is also a mask and a way to not address actual problems in your behavior and you know, things that you need to change in order to get better.
Or how many people do like, that's my identity, that negative thing.
Yeah.
Like
especially in, you know, PD circles.
Yeah. Like, I'm a bully kind of person, so I'm always going to constantly be like that. Yeah. I'm like an asshole, so I'm going to constantly be like that. Instead of being like, what is it about these behaviors I have that are, like, harming me?
Yeah.
What about it is benefiting me? Like, people develop things for, like, a bunch of various reasons, and sometimes it's, like, self-defense.
Self-victimizing posture that a lot of people can take about their own bad behavior. Like, aren't I so very put upon because I am an asshole and a bully to people?
From a farther away, like, perspective, you understand why that person's like that, but it's like, well, they're like that, you know?
Yeah. Even if you can understand why someone is behaving like this, you still shouldn't have to deal with them being like that.
Like, your behavior still... behaving. It's sort of like the difference between like different like therapy moods, like the psychoanalyzing therapy style of being like, well, you're violent because violence was done to you and now you're violent, versus like whatever else, we're like, well, you shouldn't be violent to someone else now in the present tense.
Yeah, the difference between like validation and confrontation.
That's good.
That's why you can't do the traditional, like, couch therapy psychoanalysis for people with more complex needs, like personality disorders and stuff, because when you validate people who are in these specific kinds of behavior cycles, it does not incentivize them to change their behavior. That's the other thing about, like, when the author character is talking about, like, how there is literally nothing that can make you stop being addicted, when, like, we know that that's not true for a lot of people. Like, we know that people, like go into remission or recovery. Yeah, it is just saying that, like you are already damned. It's like that whole thing, like, people who are very depressed or very suicidal, like, one of the refrains that I have heard from a lot of people who are, like, not getting the help that they need, or, like, have like, this negative self-talk and share it with other people, is the idea that, like, if you're suicidal, you will never get better. You will kill yourself eventually. Which is not true.
That's not... Like... Sorry. So it's a pass or fail system on that one. really arrogant to assume you wouldn't be, like, murdered or, like, dying in an accident or a disease or something. Jeez. That kind of, like, notion of being, like, damaged, so there's no point in, like, repair when you're, like, not an object that's retains damage. Although, the, like, philosophies of, like, you hold the damage in you and stuff, like, that makes me really upset. But...
like, body keeps the score stuff. I've seen some things recently of people being like, that book is a bunch of horseshit.
Oh, I should read people's, like, not debunking, that sounds immature. What's the appropriate word for debunking?
Rebuttals?
Rebuttal? Is rebuttal what I was looking for? I should read people's rebuttals.
There's this article that I recently reread it, and I think about it constantly. Mm-hmm. The Case Against the Trauma Plot. I feel like I've probably brought it up on the podcast before.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good. It's good. Good bit of stuff.
I don't agree with everything in it. I probably also said that if I've talked about it before.
I think you might have. It's just, like, it's good to have, like, that topic broached.
Yeah, like, it talks about the way that trauma theory... the role that has started to play in modern psychology and the way people talk about trauma and how essentially, like, that kind of way of talking about it is given prestige by people who essentially have a stake in people talking about trauma in a specific way because they are the theorists who represent this method of talking about trauma.
Yeah. Okay, so, like, I feel... Okay, I that made me think of two separate things. One is, like, sometimes you'll see art and people will be like, I've made this art for my trauma and stuff. And this is kind of, like, a meaner thing, I'm thinking. But, like, I don't mean it in this...
You don't mean it to be cruel?
I don't mean it to be cruel. You know what I mean. You'll see art and people will, like, cite, like... I am expressing my trauma through this piece. I'm expressing something negative that happened to me through this piece without, like, I'm expressing a specific thing. And it's like, is your pain, like, equivalent to mine? Is your pain equivalent to anyone else? Like, if you're like, being featured in, like, an established art journal or whatever, and it's like, well, that didn't seem to be a hindrance to you being here and that me looking at you right now. So, like, what is, like, the weight of your injury? I know it's, like, a nasty thing to think about, but sometimes it's, like, within Mother Horse Eyes, him talking about, like, well, this fucked up thing happened to me, and that's probably why I'm fucked up. I can't think of anything else, so do it. But sometimes it's, like, your continued actions... And it's, like, at the same time, like, dismissing, like, your body keeps score stuff. And sometimes, like, also, but, like, a thing did happen. I'm always going to keep this thing that happened, and it's going to affect my life. And people who have not had that thing happen can no longer relate to me. They are, like, free of this thing. It exists to them as, like, an abstract concept. And, like, people... I don't want to make a broad general thing, but, like, people... sometimes, I think, subconsciously avoid people who have, like, heavier experiences, I guess, because, like, they don't need to invite that into their world. Like, it was absence before you brought it into the world.
If I can check you real quick, I think you're kind of falling into the same kind of trap that the author character presents of essentially, like, saying, like,
oh no, I don't think that 100% about anything. I just
like the thing that he is essentially getting at, like, the rhetorical strategy that he is using in this, when he talks about, like, when he says basically a thing that, like, boils down to, like, if you disagree with this, if you think something different, that means that you just haven't experienced anything as bad as I've experienced, kind of thing.
No, yeah. I didn't mean anything, like, well, I don't think that 100% anyway, but what I mean is, like, you can get into that kind of thinking, and it's hard to, like, dispel it completely. It's an irrational thought. It's, like, a non-real thought, but, like, it is, like, something people who are in a lot of pain need, like, validating before they can heal often. But, like, then it gets stuck into, like, that constant, like, loop of, like, needing validation for that. And yeah. Seeing people as, like, hostile and lesser because of it.
Yeah, the way that we value suffering as a virtue.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the antidote to that is to remember and to help people acknowledge that another person's suffering has nothing to do with you. Like, it's tempting to make comparisons for one reason or another. Like this person hasn't suffered enough, or I haven't suffered enough, etc. But making comparisons just isn't useful. Which is, like, I'm not meaning to, like, accuse you of holding specific values. I just mean, like, that is, because I did want to talk about that also, like, because that is a wounded point of view. Like, it's understandable why people...
You get distorted thinking when you're injured is, like, the whole point. Sometimes I speak in, like, really, like, absolutes. I don't mean them in absolute ways.
I want to be better at, like, not speaking in absolutes so much.
It's hard.
Or, like, not thinking in absolutes, because, like...
It's hard, but it's good for you not to. Like, you, general, not you specifically. I think you're pretty good at being around...
I try to be, like, even. I don't always succeed. Certain people just piss me off too much.
I think you're even more often than not, but people expect you to be, like, involved more than, you know what I mean?
Like, okay, I think I express more evenly than what I'm thinking a lot of the time is part of what you're perceiving.
Listen, that's what matters at the end of the day, I think. You're allowed to have private thoughts.
I have some private thoughts that can be pretty nasty and extreme, and I just, like, hold those in, because I'm like, that's not appropriate, can't say that.
Listen, that's good DBT.
Yeah, exactly. I'm worksheeting myself.
Gold star. A good sticker. Completely unrelated to anything we're talking about, I thought it was really interesting that the mother flesh was kind of like a globster at the end.
Like the skin ship?
Yeah. Like, it's described with, like, hot dogs and stuff, and, like, wobbly appendages. Like, yeah, it has, like, tubular growths. Like, it's, like, that's just, like, cancer, but my mental image was, like, oblong ovals. I think it's oblong, the thing. Let me read it.
Like, you're talking about, like, the sort of, like, fin-like appendages that it has, right?
Oh, yeah, like a lobster.
Like, I guess it's kind of a globster, except it hasn't beached yet.
It's called, it has globular objects along the structure of the surface. Apparently an oblong object with a number of as many as 12 thin appendages along its body. So I assumed it was, like...
You were picturing lobster. Hot dogs.
I was picturing, like, hot dog shape.
I was imagining it looking basically like if a whale was just meat.
Yeah, meat whale.
Yeah, like...
Oh, hey! Do you think it's intentional because we got whales way earlier?
It blows water out of its blowhole and dies.
Oh, obviously, sorry.
Like, yeah.
I'm just, like, silly today. I'm so silly and smooth.
And, like the way that, you know, whales are, like... supposed to be, like, really intelligent and empathetic, and, like, whales and dolphins being considered, like, near humans in intelligence and communication ability and blah blah blah.
It's nice to have that as, like, the aquatic cosmic horror instead of, like, squids and stuff. Which, like, they're fine and all.
Yeah, squids get a lot of play. Like, there's no tentacles or anything in this, which, like, that was a complaint that we had about Dogscape. Was that, like, it just kind of goes right...
Yeah, there's just random tentacles all the place.
Yeah, which is, like, dumb. Like,
dogs don't have tentacles.
Yeah, dogs don't have tentacles! This is dog-themed.
Stupid. Dog 101.
The Mother Horse Eyes author knows for a fact that humans don't have tentacles.
So you don't see any. Yay! We're closer to whales than, like, not, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, we're fair. Like, they're mammals.
Yeah, any given time we could do that. Stand in the water long enough.
God, I wish.
I know.
We need to go back. We made a mistake.
Yeah, and we won't have to stand all the time. Think of all the stuff we can get done.
I mean, before we can, like, reintegrate into the ocean, we're gonna have to invent, like, water capable devices.
Oh yeah, we need water internet first.
Waternet.
Like the dolphins can hook onto that like instantly.
Waternet is like when I'm fishing.
Well, it looks like we're going to wrap it up there for tonight. Let us know your thoughts on Mother Horse Eyes. Give us a like and share us with your friends. Next episode, we continue Mother Horse Eyes with narratives 66 to 85. This has been the Creepypasta Book Club. Thank you, and good night.